What would make someone willingly run 135 miles through Death Valley? Not 13.1 miles, not 26.2, but 135 miles through one of the hottest places on Earth with extreme heat, brutal climbs and descents, sleep deprivation, nutrition and hydration challenges, and plenty of opportunities for your mind to tell you that you've had enough. And yet every year, runners line up for the Badwater 135. Today, you're going to hear what that experience is actually like from someone who just lived it. Vanessa Klein. She is the founder of Beast Pacing and an experienced ultra runner and pacer. I recently had the opportunity to talk with Vanessa about her running, her work as a pacer, and what she brings to runners who are willing to go far beyond the marathon. But after she completed the 2026 Badwater 135, I knew there was another conversation we needed to have. This one is about the race. What does 135 miles actually do to your body and your mind? How do you deal with the heat? What happens when you're exhausted, you're hurting, and you still got miles and miles to go? How do you manage food, fluids, electrolytes, energy, when your body doesn't necessarily want any of them? And perhaps most importantly, what happens inside your head when you reach the point where quitting starts to sound like a pretty good idea? Whether you're a beginner runner who is still working toward your first 5K, a marathoner dreaming about an ultra someday, or someone who simply wonders what drives people to take on something this extreme, Vanessa has a story that I think you're going to find fascinating. So let's go inside one of the world's most notorious ultramarathons. This is Vanessa Klein and the Badwater 135. And this is the Running for Beginners podcast.
Hey, everybody. We're back again with another episode talking to Vanessa Klein of Beast Pacing, but we're doing it a little different on this one. We're going to talk about her personal ultra running journey in a Badwater 135 interview. Oh, thanks again for letting me do this, Vanessa. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I could talk forever about this race. I really, really had a good time.
Well, that's good because we're gonna figure that out. So before we get in Badwater, take me back to the beginning. How did you go from being a runner to becoming an ultra runner?
So I started running when I was in high school. I started running cross country. Maybe I won't age myself, but
that's okay. I already aged myself. You already know.
1995.
My Lord.
I started cross country. I ran for the school called Sultana High School, and I had the most amazing and encouraging coach who was very hard on us, but he taught me to work hard. His name is John Marr. I hope he gets to listen to this. I know he's like still around. He commented on my Facebook after I posted about Badwater. And he was like a really, at the time, like, I don't think that he or I knew it, but like, he was a very like important piece of like my growing up and just like learning how to work hard and go after your goals. So after high school, I had a little bit of like childhood trauma and I was kind of got myself into like, just, you know, a little too much drinking and things like that. So I kind of fell off the wagon. And then about 10 years later, I started running. I had had my third baby. Her name's Harper, and she's going to be 15 years old this year. And I was like, I really want to get in shape, but I didn't trust that I could do it myself. So I was like, I'm going to sign up for a marathon, and it's probably really going to hurt, but it will be even worse if I do not train for it. So that was my like way to get myself to start, like, you know, working out, because I didn't think that I could just do it on my own. I needed like a training plan. So I went online, got a training plan. Anyways, as I was leading up to my first marathon, one of my longer runs I needed to do was like 18 or 20 miles. And I found these two women that lived kind of in the same area as me. And they kind of had a little running like group going on. And one of them was Cheryl Zworkowski. She's an 8-time Badwater finisher. Wow. The other one's name is Laura. I'm just drawing a blank on her last name, but they were like, hey, we're doing, you know, I needed a long run. They were like, we're doing this run along the PCT out and back, but we need you to leave your car in the middle. So they were not sure that I could complete the distance like on trail. So they were being safe, which I totally understand. I would do too. Funny. This is the first time meeting me. So I get it, right? I do the run. I was fine. We went out and back, went and retrieved my car or whatever. And Cheryl started becoming somewhat of a mentor for me. I ran my first marathon with San Diego Rock and Roll. And then before I ran that race, I actually was signed up for a second one. During my training, my sister was like, are you going to run like another marathon after this? And I was like, yeah, right. It's a lot of work. It's like taking a lot of my time. Probably I'm just going to run this one. But then I signed up for St. George Marathon because some of my friends were wanting to get into it. And I think what we did is we signed up as a group to go in the lottery because we had a better chance. I can't remember, something like that. And so in leading up to the training for the second marathon, I asked Cheryl, could she help me with a training plan? And I didn't realize at the time, but what she was doing was she was like prepping me to run ultras. She had me doing back long runs of like 20 to 25 miles back to back on the weekends. And I just thought like, oh, that's what we're doing, right? I had no idea like that kind of like wasn't a thing for just marathon running.
Sure.
I think she saw that I had potential and was like kind of, without me knowing it, encouraging me to tap into that.
Nice.
So fast forward. So that would have been 2013. So let's see. I ran my first, Harper was born in 2011. I ran my first marathon in 2012. And actually that would have been 2012 because I ran my first 50 miler a couple weeks after running a St. George marathon. It was a terrible experience. It was out and back on a gravel road like a bunch of times. And I remember at like 27 or 28 miles, I was like, how am I going to do this? And the guy and his girlfriend that were working the aid station were like, just get to like 35 and like, you'll be able to like wrap your head around it. Cause I at that time I was just like, I don't know how I'm going to go another marathon basically, you know? So I did that. I finished it. And then I was like, whatever I do next, like it's going to be better than that. I'm going to have a better course. I'm going to have a better experience. Like I'll be more rested, whatever. And it just kind of snowballed from there. So I started running a ton of ultras,
that was the turning point then. I mean, that was like a specific race or distance that you just said, I can actually do an ultra.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never did. Before I ran a marathon, I didn't run a half marathon. And before I ran a 50 miler, I did not run a 50K. I was like, six more miles. I'm going.
We did the same thing last year. I ran the Bass Pro and six days after it, I ran my first 40 miler.
Yeah.
And now this year, I'm doing the same thing. Bass Pro again, 6 days later, but it's a 50K. So
I love it.
It's just, there's no rules to this stuff. Just do what you want to do.
There is not.
Yeah.
There is not rules to it. So yeah. And it just kind of got crazy from there. I ran a ton of marathons like in 2013, 14, I was running a lot of marathons. There used to be this list called Best Frequent Marathoners of the US. I was on that list for a couple years. And I wasn't crazy fast, but like I ran a lot of races faster than like the median of people, you know, which is how I got on that list. Some people, like I think Camille Herron was on that list at the same time as me, but you know, she only needed to run a few marathons because she was running like 3 hours, maybe sub three. I was running like 3:40 to 4 hours, maybe faster than that a little bit here and there. But it just kind of snowballed. And I found, you know, kind of trail running through Cheryl. And even though I had been on the PCT, I think with my cross country team here and there, but I really found it like, you know, after I started running with her. And I actually went, so I know we're going to talk about Badwater, but I actually went back. I was trying to figure out when was the first time I was at Badwater. I mean, it was in 2012, in the summer of 2012, Cheryl did a triple crossing and I paced and crewed her through some of that. And I still have those photos. It was really cool to put those on Instagram a few weeks ago. Just like the morning of the race, I actually posted them. Nice. I thought it was 2014, but it was 2012 when I had been out there. So that's how my running journey started.
That's crazy. So what was the longest distance that you completed before Badwater 135?
So the interesting thing about it is I was on a like seriously major upward trajectory. Like I was feeling super good. And then I think it was March 21st. I was running just like a training race, a 50 kilometer race. I was like just in this flow state doing well. And I stepped on like a stump that was like under leaves and I like rolled my left ankle really bad. I mean, I went to like the ER. I was pretty sure it was broken or something. I was like, I couldn't walk on it or anything. I didn't want to create a disruption for the race. So I was like, when I did that, I hyped my way out and it was only 2.5 miles, but it took me a long time. My partner, John, was actually out there like taking some video of me and like cheering me on. And it took him a long time to even find me. He found me like half a mile to go before I got back to like the race headquarters. Cause it was, I think it was like a 15 mile loop and then some shorter loops. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, I really couldn't stand on it or weight bear on it at all. So I had to not run a single step for almost 3 weeks exactly. And then it was like, okay, I could try 1 mile. So right before I hurt myself, I had connected with this gym called Evo Performance and Health, and they were creating a strength routine for me because that is a piece of my running that I had kind of lacked or just not given the time to. And I knew that if I wanted to do the best I could at Badwater, I needed to connect with a coach and get some direction because I know what my lane is and that's not it.
Sure.
And I know like I'm not afraid to like reach out to people for help or, you know, if somebody has more expertise in an area, like I want to know it and I want to get help with it. So I reached out and we connected, we created the training, you know, or he created, my friend TJ Martino created a training plan for me. And then I had this injury. So when that happened, I mean, I was devastated. I was embarrassed. I was like, you know, you're supposed to be tough. And like, here you are, you're hurt. And I had to really come to terms with the fact that like, this is an accident. Like this isn't, I didn't like overtrain or do something. Like it was just a freak thing, you know? And I went back to him and I'm like, well, I guess I'll see you in a few weeks, you know, when I'm better. And he said, no. He's like, no, this is how we do this. And I was like, really? He's yeah, we're going to start mobility right away. And he basically curated a whole new plan to get me back to like good.
Nice.
And he had me doing like literally mobility from the moment I hurt myself. And I truly believe that that was the biggest factor, listening to him and taking his advice and like just being patient was the biggest factor in me being able to run Badwater. And I've like told him thank you, but I don't think that anybody understands like how important that really was. Like I realize it now, but like in the time I was just like, how are we going to get there? Sorry, I might get a little emotional.
That's okay. That's all right.
It was a journey. So anyways, my intention was to top out my running at 100 mile weeks. I know you're asking about like what the longest run I did before that. But with that injury, even in May, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it to the start line. I actually at one point looked at the date of like, when could I pull out of the race and possibly get some money back, right? If I'm not going to attend. And when I looked, we had already passed that date. And I said, all right, well, I guess we're going, you know, I was still on track, like trying to prepare myself to get there, but I wasn't feeling super confident.
Right.
And then, you know, things were getting better. I was having no ankle pain. I was like super stoked about that. My paces were getting a little bit faster. And I was trying to get into this race called TGNY 100, which is in New York City. It's all pavement, which I felt like that would be the best option for a training race for me because Badwater is on pavement. And unfortunately, I was just like too far down on the list. I couldn't get in. And my friends were running a race called a brand new 100 miler called Woodbugger 100 in Southwest Virginia. And it was the week before TGNY. And I'm like, this is probably my best shot to get in a long run to like test and make sure that I can go at least 100 miles. Because I figured if I couldn't go 100 miles, how am I going to go 135, right? And I'm like, well, it's probably going to be trail. So it'll be a little more technical and I'll have to deal with that. But like, this is my option to get into 100 miler.
Sure.
So I signed up. And actually what happened was from the time that these two women created their race, it essentially was supposed to be all trail. However, there was like storms from last year that had gone through the area. And so they had to revise their course. And really only the first 11 or 12 miles, like there was some road, then we hit some trail. But by the time we got to like 12 miles, we were pretty much on either road or dirt road, which was perfect for me because I was still concerned about protecting my ankle. So during those trail sections, it was a two 50 mile loops. During those trail sections, I really just like took it easy during those sections. And then I tried to give most of my effort to like when we were on stuff that was less technical, you know, fire road, or there was some pavement also. And when I came into, backing up a little bit. So I went there with a couple friends and like really the goal was like just finish the race, like get through 100 miles. I think the cutoff maybe was like, it had a pretty good cutoff for like a lot of people could finish it. You know, okay. It wasn't going to be very tight. And I was like, this is great. I might need that time. Like, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about it is like, we started the race and around, like I knew it was a smaller race. So there wasn't like a ton of like people in it, but I realized around, I think 35 miles, I came into an aid station where my friend was, and I knew that she was probably leading the race. I was kind of like watching like who I passed and like how many people were out there. I passed the woman that was in second place going into that aid station. And then I left with my friend Kate and our friend Michael out of that aid station. We took this long climb. It was like 9 miles. I don't know. It was a crazy, crazy long climb. It was a lot. And we left out of there together. And then when we got to the top, like my friend is tough. Like she is a tough cookie. And I was like, I kind of want to see what I can do. So I started hammering when we got to the top. I just hammered down into the town. And I found myself lead female, and I just kind of like never let up. I just kept trying to like push hard. And I ended up winning the race, which felt really good. Of course, it's a course record because it's like a first year. But the race had like 16,000 feet of gain. And I think I ran like 27 something. I can't remember. Maybe it was 27:20. I'm not exactly sure of my time, but I was very happy about how that race went. I had zero ankle pain. Nice. I wore the same pair of shoes and socks. Thank you, Hoka. Hoka was supporting me through this like journey to like Badwater. Same pair of shoes and socks. Never changed my shoes. Never changed my socks. No blisters. No hot spots. No foot issues. Man, my quads were wrecked after that though, because the steep ups and downs were something. So that is like a long 10-minute answer to my longest run was 100 miles. I'm sorry.
Hey, everybody. It's your host, Mike Fleming. I've recently added another staple to my running kit, these UCAN energy gels. I started using them during the Austin Marathon, and I fell in love. So now they're always one of three things I take on my runs, and you should add them to your running kit as well. With UCAN gels, you get advanced glucose control, which is the foundation of energy and performance. You'll have no energy crashes because there's no sugar, which means there's no spikes, which means a steady fuel supply. You'll also have more fat utilization, which enhances your body's ability to burn fat or fuel. And you won't have gut issues because of their unique digestive advantage, even at high carb doses. UCAN has patented a supercarb technology called Live Steady. It's an extended-release supercarb backed by over a dozen clinical trials, has a unique ability to deliver high amounts of energy while keeping glucose levels steady, helping prevent crashes. One of the coolest things about UCAN was that it was created to save a life. Jonah, a boy with glycogen storage disease, needed to prevent life-threatening blood sugar drops. His parents and scientists developed LiveSteady, which fuels athletes with steady energy through the power of glucose control. And for a limited time, if you use a code running for beginners when checking out at ucan.co, you'll get 20% off your purchase. Just use the code running for beginners. Into this and wonder, you know, if they can do something like that. And so when they hear you go through a trial or, a tough time and come out ahead, then that's just more motivation for people listening. So what attracted you to Badwater 135? You said, and I didn't know this because I haven't looked up many trail races or ultras example. It's all on pavement, you said?
Yes, it is all road. There is not a lick of shade until you get up to Mount Whitney portal. Like there is, wow. You are just like, it's open road. There's no trees. There's nowhere to hide. You are stripped down to dealing with the heat regardless. You know, some years are hotter than others, but there's nowhere to hide. There is nowhere to hide out there.
What month is it held in?
July. So I just ran. Geez. The race this year was July 27th.
Wow.
So
they couldn't pick a cooler month, huh?
No. I think the whole point is for it to be difficult, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I know, right? Yeah. So what drew me to the race is, you know, when I went there with Cheryl, it's just like this vast, like it makes you feel this big. Because you can see very far. It's a lot of, you know, it's desert with like not a lot of like tall trees or plants or whatever. So you can just, some places you can see for freaking miles, and it can, man, it is sometimes real tough on the mind. Like taking 190 out to highway 395, which is, so you get into Lone Pine, which is mile 122, but for like I don't know how many miles we're on that same road for. Like, it's more than 50. I don't know. And it's like a long road. You can see forever. Like, wow. Literally, let's see, is it 50 miles? I'm trying to think. I don't know the exact, I should know this. I was just out there and I ran it, but
that's crazy.
It's just a long, you know, you can, I think what tracks me is that I love doing hard things. And when it's something that's going to break you down, just like to your core, I'm like, yes, let me have it. You know, nice.
You're going to take on that challenge.
Yeah. I love seeing what I'm made of. I love being, I guess, tough, you know, like I don't know if that's like a personality trait or whatever, but I love doing hard things. I love being tough. I love knowing that like whatever life might hand me that I can deal with it. You know, it might be a difference of like, it might take me a long time. It might take me a short amount of time, but like whatever it is, I know I can get through it. And that's like, I think something that I like about that race is that it's going to be hard. You're going to have challenges. And honestly, in most 100 milers, you're going to have challenges. Like, you know, I always say you're not going to have a perfect race. So it's just like waiting to see what's going to fall apart. And then it's like a puzzle. How do you fix it? Right. I think that's what I like about ultras. Actually, I am also a person that really enjoys puzzles, any type of puzzle. And so I think like when, you know, you have a stomach issue or something, you're just trying to figure it out. And you're trying to like go through all the things of like, how do I fix this? So
what attracted you specifically to Badwater? Like for someone who's never run Badwater before, you described the road race and all the distances and the openness, but what makes Badwater 135 different from another ultra marathon?
Okay. Sorry. I lost my screen for a second. I would say, so what makes Badwater different from any other ultra marathon? Well, number one, you have to qualify and apply for it. So it is in the hottest place on earth. That's number one. Number two, you have to qualify and apply for it. And all of the applicants are hand selected. So there's not like, if you do these things, you're going to get in. You submit your application with your race history and a short essay of like why you feel like you should be invited to run the race. And then the board, you know, the Badwater board hand selects who gets to run the race. So that's what makes it different. Also, there are only 100 people every year selected. I'm confident that's probably due to, you know, permitting and just being able to like keep the race alive. So I think one of the things that probably that goes into consideration with the board is like also choosing people that are going to like follow rules, because I know that they're probably under some very strict eyeballs and making sure that like, you know, we're not destroying the park, you know, it's in Death Valley National Park. And I will tell you, I saw during the race so many park rangers. Like, you know, rules are put in place on the race to be able to keep the race alive. So I think that also when the board chooses people, they try to choose people that maybe have good ethics, yet that are tough people, but also like you got to be able to follow rules and make sure, because otherwise if we don't all follow the rules, the race could disappear at any moment. Right. If each one of us does not do our part of like following the rules, you know? I mean, there's weird rules in this race. Like, so you cannot defecate, you know, just like behind a bush or something. You have to do it in a, what's called a Biffy bag. And if you want a fun little demonstration, there's one on Instagram. We are totally close.
I'm sure there are. Yeah. I'm sure there would be.
We did a fun little video last year. So yeah, there's a lot of rules, but they're in place to keep the race alive.
Sure.
You know?
That's
more rules than you would find in normal ultra marathons. You know, normally you're going to like poop on the ground and like bury it or whatever, but that is not how this race works.
So, and
it's a very like community feel too. You kind of like, you join this like Badwater family, which is very welcoming, and like the people are great and you just get really connected to them because you've gone through this very difficult experience, you know?
Sure. So let's talk about the environment. Like, you're running 135 miles through the Death Valley, some of the most extreme heat on the planet. What does that heat actually feel like when you're trying to run?
Well, if you're heat trained and you have the proper gear, like a good sun hoodie, then it's not terrible.
You want to give a shout out to the sun hoodie that you used?
Yes, I do actually, because I tried several. Like, I've tried a number of them, and I'm not going to, I don't want to like pick on the companies that I don't feel.
Yeah, no, just.
Yeah. One that I felt worked the best for me is called the Steel Vessant hoodie. And I think Steel is mostly like mountain gear. I think they're geared toward like hikers and mountain bikers, not necessarily ultra running, but I just found it by accident. I actually purchased it because I liked how it looked. And when I got it, the material felt a little bit different. And I remember I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. It felt like a weird, almost like papery feel. Mm-hmm. It was strange. And I even asked my mom, I was like, feel these two like materials, which one do you think is going to be better? And she's like, I think this Steel one might be better. So I think that the reason that it works well is because when it dries, it comes away from your skin. It doesn't stay sitting on your skin. And to me, I think that is that's what makes it superior to some of the others that I've tried.
Can you spell that brand name for me?
S-T-I-O.
Okay. Steel.
Yeah. And it was like, it's called the Vessant hoodie. They have a number of different sun hoodies. The one that I purchased was a Vessant hoodie. It has two snaps, so it can tighten up really tight, like near your face and your chin to keep it from like blowing off your head. That worked incredibly well. And also I think like being heat trained like really helps too. So sure. I purposely, this was a super hard decision for me, especially because even, you know, leading up a few months before the race, I was like, I don't even know if I was going to make it to the race, you know, based on my ankle. But I told myself, if I'm going to go do this race, like I want to give myself the best shot at doing as well as I can. So my original goal before I got hurt was to hopefully run under 36 hours and then to be in the top 10 women, which I felt like was a very big pipe dream. I was like, everything's going to have to go right for this to happen. But if I do all these things, maybe I can do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces to my training was I told myself, if you're going to do the best, you have to go be out there in the dry heat before the race and train out there. So I talked to my family, my kids, and my partner, John, and I was like, I want to go out basically like a month before the race and be somewhere where it's dry heat so I can do some long runs and just basically like bake myself and get myself used to heat training. I'm going to back up just a little bit because also, prior to this, I was going in a sauna twice a week for 30 minutes, anywhere between 210 and 225 degrees. It's weird. Some days felt easy and some days felt harder. But I did that 2 days a week. I had been doing that for months, basically since the time I started working with Evo Performance and Health. I was utilizing their sauna there. And I think that elevated me a little bit. And then also going out and actually being in the dry heat, I went out to Mesquite, Nevada, where my uncle has a home. Shout out to my uncle, Tom. Thank you so much for sharing your home with me. So I stayed out in Mesquite, Nevada, which is very dry, very dry, hot, desert climate also. It's about probably 4.5 hours away from Lone Pine. I'm trying to think. Sorry, probably maybe 4 hours away from Badwater Basin, actually. Yeah. But anyways, it was the perfect environment for me to train. And I would go out there purposely in the middle of the day and do runs. There were times when I would have something going on and I wouldn't be able to run till the evening. And the problem was running in the evening, I felt like I could go forever. And so I told myself, I'm like, you have to make it a priority to be out in the middle of the day, getting the sun on you, getting beat. I got a hell of a tan. And I think that really played a huge role. I think sometimes people underestimate how hot it can be in Death Valley. But for me, like I've been out there several times. I've paced and crewed a number of different people besides Cheryl. And I know how hot it can be. I paced and crewed my partner, John Swanson last year during it. And when we were in Panamint Valley, he came through there in the late after, like maybe it was like 5 or 6 PM. And it was so hot that I didn't want to get out of the vehicle to crew him. Mm. I mean, I did it, but like, I was like, OMG, how is he even running in this? Like, how is he doing this? And his pacer, Kate, they just kept running our thermometer on our car. Now, obviously this is not real temperatures, but like you can kind of estimate how hot it was. Our temperature gauge on the vehicle when he was running through Panamint Valley was 137.
Damn.
Yes. And like when we would get out, it just felt like a hairdryer on you. Like it was wicked, wicked hot. He was having to pick up his hands and hold them up here when he was running because his fingers were burning from being like close to the ground, you know, or closer to the ground. So yeah. And my crew said in the first 20 miles, I think they clogged 121 or something on like the temperature gauge. And they said it felt like a hairdryer was like blowing them in the face. The crazy thing about it is when I started, there was this incredible tailwind, which was what was blowing them in the face. To me, So at night, I did not wear a sun hoodie. I just wore a sports bra, shorts, and, you know, we have to wear lights and reflective vest. But we had this incredible tailwind, and they were like, it was awful. We don't know how you were running through that. I'm like, it was behind me. So it just was pushing me. I'm sure if I turned around, I would have felt the same way as them.
Right.
But it's funny how you have that like different experience, you know?
Yeah, of course.
People underestimate heat training, especially for this race.
Hi, everybody. If you've seen any of my running or lifting posts, you know that I talk about these Roan Honey Packs. They're part of my everyday kit, no matter the workout. Roan was created to fuel moments of deep focus and peak performance. With nature's best ingredients, their honey helps you escape the noise and get in the zone. Roan Nutrition's supercharged honey packets is nature's energy in your pocket. Their raw honey-based fuel gives a clean, natural boost of energy. Roan Supercharged Honey allows for easy digestion, has all natural ingredients, provides sustainable energy, and comes in delicious flavors. And there's also caffeine-free versions. Roan Supercharged Honey is powered by 4 real ingredients to fuel your flow, each with a purpose. Raw honey for energy, pink Himalayan salt for hydration, caffeine from green tea for clean focus, and lion's mane mushroom for mental clarity. Check them out at RoanNutrition.com. That's Roan, spelled R-O-N-E. And for a limited time, if you use the code RUNWITHMIKE at checkout, you'll get 20% off your purchase. Just remember to use the code RUNWITHMIKE. So that kind of goes into the next question then. So like, what does a typical training week look like when you're preparing for a 135-mile race?
Well, if you're Vanessa Klein and you don't have a coach, it's kind of whatever you want. I don't have a coach. I don't follow a training plan.
But you got a friend who's an 8-time finisher for Badwater. You could have tapped into her, I would assume.
Yeah. Well, we've disconnected a little bit since then. But, you know, like my goal was I wanted to top out at running several 100-mile weeks. I never got there. I think I got to like, I mean, aside from Woodbugger running the 100-miler, like obviously I hit 100 miles that week. But aside from that, I think I topped out at like 80, maybe 80, maybe high 80s. And really, I think that was for 1 week. But I know that like using back-to-back long runs is like super important in ultra marathon training, like regardless. I've never had a coach. I've kind of like felt like, you know, aside from Cheryl creating a training plan for me that one time, but I kind of feel like my lifestyle is very different and I get pulled in a lot of directions. You know, I'm a mom, like John and I have 5 kids and, you know, 2 of them are out of the house, but we still have 3 that are, you know, in high school and like doing all the things. And I've always felt like if I had a coach, I'd probably be letting them down because I don't think I can always do the workouts on certain days. And I know people like move things around. I have considered getting a coach to see kind of like what could I do because I think there's some untapped potential.
Well, I got a referral for you.
All right. I love it.
So I'm going through with an ultra coach right now.
Okay.
A lady who's an ultra coach that I interviewed a couple episodes ago, and she got hired on. She was a coach on her own. She got hired on to the Everyday Ultra team.
Uh-huh. That's Joe Corcione's team. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they're training me for my ultra, and then I'll use that training as an episode.
Okay. Very cool. I love that.
So I get to go through the experience and then I regurgitate the experience on an episode.
Yeah.
And I, so far, and I've done a marathon coach before who, another person that I interviewed, and he trained me up for another marathon, but never an ultra. And their system is a lot different using Training Peaks and all the stuff they give you. I would, if you're looking for a coach, I'd hook up with someone on that team.
I definitely have thought about it. I just always feel like because like sometimes I don't know when I'm going to be able to do a long run, right? Like I just kind of fit it in where I can because life is just crazy busy. Not just with like our kids, but you know, we own 2 businesses, Beast Pacing and Beast Coast Productions. And those things are just like, they're like another child each, like maybe more. So I've always felt like if I had a coach, I might let them down, you know, but I'd be lying if I said my curiosity wasn't piqued by wondering how would things change or.
Right. Well, I did the same thing. I've ran 2 marathons before and like, I don't know, maybe 12 halves. But when I wanted to use the coaching experience, I wanted to make sure that I would be able to do it 100% so that if Well, no. So if I failed or if I succeeded, whatever, there would be no excuse for myself. It was, I did what I was supposed to do and either I blew it that day or not, but I'm not going to blame it on I skipped a training run or I skipped this or my diet was crap or whatever, you know. So I use it as something to keep me on track so I wouldn't have an excuse if I didn't succeed in my goal. So that was my benefit to using them.
Yeah. So my thing is I won't intentionally try to like skip runs or anything like that. So I don't feel like I need that little, you know, like some people, it works better if they have like a schedule, you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's what I need actually for strength training. I need that like accountability of like, I need to go in here, but running, I love running. So for me to say like, oh, I need to do 30 mile run. Okay. I'm going to go do it. Like, it's not a fight, you know, like in my brain.
Right.
And I think that's what helps me, but I am very curious, like if I honed in on things, like I don't do any speed training, I don't do speed work at all, nothing, zero. But I do also think that for the most part, that also keeps me healthy.
Sure.
You know, aside from like this freak ankle thing, I've had a couple of freak things where I like one time, like I also broke my right foot doing jumping jacks one time. Like it was so dumb. Just rolled it right out of my shoe. But aside from that, like even with like doing a lot of miles or what to some people is a lot of miles, I usually don't get injured. And I truly think that is because I don't do a lot of speed work, even like before strength training. Like I just don't do it. Now during my strength workouts, my coach did have me, I did an incredible amount of pushing a sled, which was very difficult for me. I hated every single time of doing that, but I did it, you know, and I think that kind of like ties into like more like speed work because it was like pushing a sled fast, you know, X number of reps. Sometimes it was some ungodly amount where the other trainers in the gym were like, are you sure that's right? And I'm like, I'm like, that's what it says. And we'd ask, you know, TJ, and he'd be like, that's what it is. And I'm like, oh man, he's either going to kill me or I'm going to be super freaking strong. So, and I think it worked out.
Yeah, 100%. So at some point during the 135, your body's going to tell you to stop. How do you distinguish between, quote, like, this is really hard and I need to stop because something's actually wrong?
You know, I never experienced that actually. I never did. And I'm not a person that like where quitting like will replay in my head. I mean, there are some races that I run where it's like, oh my God, this is going to be a long time. Like, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you can do this? You know, things like that. But during Badwater, I think because the fact that like, so most of the time when I run races, I don't have any pacers or crew, right? Like, I just am not a person that wants to ask people like, hey, I'm going to run this race in wherever. Do you want to like come with me and freaking sit around and wait all day for me? I hate asking people that. I think there's a lot of people that would enjoy doing that and would love doing it. But like, to me, it feels like asking someone to like give up their whole weekend for what? To wait on me, Vanessa Klein? Right. Like, who cares, right? So I am always like, John and I pretty much, we only just like run races using like drop bags or no crew, no pacers, nothing. And I also, that ensures that nobody's waiting for me. I hate when people are waiting for me. I'd rather be the person to wait for someone. I don't like when people are waiting for me. So I think sometimes having somebody there for you can feel like, oh my gosh, they've been there for 20 minutes waiting for me and I'm still not there. Like that can kind of get in my head a little bit. So I prefer most of the time not to use a crew or pacers, but during Badwater, you absolutely have to have a crew there. It's on, you know, there's no aid stations. There's no water. Your crew van is your aid station. And I think it was just like, this is what we're doing. Like, you know, every 2 miles, they'd give me a new water bottle and something that I would hopefully eat, which wasn't always easy. And we just kept moving forward. And actually, like, my body never told me to stop. I actually felt very strong throughout the whole entire race. The one time that my legs felt tired was going up, you know, the last climb up Whitney Portal Road. But other than that, I felt very strong. And I think that like has to do with like, I don't want to say the amount of running I did because I didn't do as much as I wanted to do. But like, I think the strength training like really helped with that. Sure. I had no feet issues. I had no blisters, which I expected.
Yeah.
No hot spots, nothing. I wore, for the most part, two different pairs of shoes. I wore the Rocket X to start. I transitioned into a Mach X. And then at one point I switched to a third pair, but only for 2 miles. Something was not right in that shoe. It didn't feel right for me. So I switched right out of it and I went back to the Rocket. So I think I got
never tried. Never tried the Rockets. Never tried the Rockets. I have the Mach X.
I don't think the Rocket technically is for running 135 miles. But you know what? For me, that shoe seemed to feel the best on my foot as far as like splay. Like right. It's a little, because the upper of that shoe, I do a lot of shoe testing. So I feel like I'm very like all the pieces of a shoe are very like ingrained in my head about like, you know, how this works, how it feels, and what makes a shoe feel tight or loose. And that shoe has like a little bit more of a minimal upper, and that seemed to be better to allow my toes. I have a problem on my right foot where my foot's just slightly wider. And so some shoes can bother kind of like my forefoot area.
Yeah, I need a wide toe box as well.
Yeah. I like the Mach X, so that's probably my favorite shoe from Hoka. I can go a lot of long distance in there, and it's some people like a cloud-like feel, and I don't. I don't like a super soft shoe, so.
Hi, everybody. It's your host. As runners, we spend a lot of time thinking about strength, building it, testing it, finding it when things get hard. As a dad of three grown kids, I know how lucky I am that our toughest moments were things like scraped knees or late night fevers. We never needed the kind of strength that comes from hearing your child is seriously ill. But countless families do, and that's where St. Jude Children's Research Hospital steps in. St. Jude gives parents something no training plan can prepare you for, hope. They take away the financial burden. No family ever receives a bill for treatment, travel, housing, or food. So parents can focus on helping their child live, regardless of the duration or the cost of care. They surround families with care, support, and world-class treatment at a time when fear and uncertainty feel overwhelming. As runners, we know what it means to show up for people, to carry someone when the miles get tough. Supporting St. Jude is one of the most meaningful ways we can do that. If you're able, I invite you to join me in helping the families who need that strength today. Donate at https://heroes.stjude.org/runningforbeginners. That's heroes.stjude.org/runningforbeginners. Thank you.
What was the lowest point for the race
point
for you? Yeah. Yeah.
So, probably I'd say like fairly early in the race, the salt wasn't working for me. Like I was, for some reason, so I had been training with using a certain product and like taking in salt. Like it was a carb salt mix, a hydration mix. And for some reason, like even though I trained with it, I didn't train every single run with it, right? Because, you know, these products are expensive and I did have some support for that. But, you know, you only get so much support when you're not an elite athlete. You know, I'm not elite. I'm just over here in New Jersey doing my thing. And so I don't have like things at my begging, you know, like I can't just say I need this and like I get it, right? So those things are expensive. And I did have to like think about budget, but I was using, you know, a hydration and sodium mixture during training. However, when I got into the race, even though it had worked for me during training, it just wasn't like something about it was upsetting my stomach. And I'm pretty confident at this point that I'm just a person that does not need as much salt as most people need. I kind of learned that through bad water. The funny thing is like I had convinced myself, well, this race is different, so you have to take in all this extra sodium, even though in most races, I do not do that. I do not take in, even in 100 miles, I won't take in extra salt. It's just whatever salt comes from either a chip I eat, a sandwich, whatever. Mm-hmm. It usually comes from those things. Like I don't take salt pills or anything like that. If I take any type of salt, it'll be like one bottle over the entire 100 miles, right? However, during training, I convinced myself that because this is bad water and it's like more extreme, that I need more salt. And I think that just, I proved to myself three different times in the race that that's not the case. So I tried one product. And then once my stomach settled, I tried another product. And every time I put salt in is when I would have an issue. So I guess my body's just unusual. You know, my friend, we were discussing it afterwards and she said, I think that your body is like, this bitch isn't going to, sorry, can I say that?
Yeah, I can edit anything out. I can leave it in. I don't care.
Not going to give us salt, but we have to learn to work without it. And she says that she thinks that my body just has learned to work without it because I don't cramp. I don't have any of those type of problems. And so I think I'm just a little bit different in that way. You know, I'm sure there's lots of people that probably are the same way. Sure. So I think having the salt issue though, very early on, like I would say that happened within the first 30 miles, which reduced me to a little bit of, I definitely had to slow down because when my stomach got funky, then I was struggling to take in calories. And so that was probably, it was a little frustrating. I don't know if it was like, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to keep going and we're just going to deal with it. And if I'm going to bonk for a little while, that's what's going to happen until I can get my stomach straight. So I just kind of like laid off of calories. And then what we found was like precision gels were like the thing that was like keeping me alive. Like I took so many precision gels and usually I will supplement with a gel if I need to, or I'll, you know, my plan was to take more precision than I had in past races. But typically I like to eat a lot of regular food, you know, like peanut butter and honey sandwiches, crackers, chips, sometimes candy. I didn't have a single piece of candy, which is like amazing because I love me a gummy bear. But my stomach just was, you know, funky. And precision gels were like really what like kept me alive and actually allowed me to like turn things around. I just wish I hadn't tried. I tried two other times, two different salt options. And both times when I did that, it did not work out. And my stomach would turn for a little bit. And then I'd be like, okay, after the third time, we're like, we can't be doing this anymore. This isn't like what's working, you know? And my crew was amazing. They were so spot on with everything. They helped me kind of make those decisions. I had talked to my crew beforehand and I basically said, I don't want to make decisions in the race. I just like, you tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. So that was like really key. I think, you know, you can't, when you're trying to run 135 miles, if you're getting aided every 2 miles, you can't have somebody saying like, do you want, you know, this or that? Like you can't make those that many, that's 70 times you're going to make a decision. And like, you would just say like, here's this, try this, you know? Yeah. And that was perfect. Like we discussed that beforehand. Cause I, in my regular life, I have decision fatigue just because I make a lot of decisions for business. So I just like, was like, I don't want to deal with any of that. And they were so good about just trying to push calories when I needed to. And then at some points they were like, okay, well, if we have no calories right now, it's fine. Like, because as long as you're not throwing up, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So walk me through race morning. Like, what was it like? What was going through your head when you stood at the starting line, knowing that you had 135 miles ahead of you?
Well, so the race starts in the evening time. There's three waves, 8, 9, and 10 p.m. And typically, those of us that are going to take a little bit longer start in the 8 p.m. wave. And that's the wave that I was put in. After we get accepted into the race, I remember we've had to fill out a form like stating like what time we thought we would finish. So under 36 hours was like my pipe dream goal. I really thought like maybe I'd be closer to like 40 hours. And so that's what I wrote down, which probably is why I ended up in the first wave. You know, after everything, after the race, I probably really should have been in the second wave, but like it doesn't really matter that much because we all are doing the same distance, you know?
Sure.
There's a little bit tighter of some of the cutoffs end up a little bit tighter. Like I think the first one, because that's like a particular time you have to get by the 50 mile mark. It's not a certain number of hours. So if you start in the later wave, you have one less hour or two less hours.
Gotcha.
So anyways, I started at 8 p.m. So the day started, we were in Lone Pine. You take the long 3.5 hour drive out to Badwater Basin. I was trying to rest throughout the day, but it is very difficult to do that. You know, your brain's just like on overdrive. I also was trying to put some music on my watch because I didn't want to carry my phone, but I wanted to have the option to have some music. So I was trying to get it onto my Garmin, and that was proving to be a little difficult, although I did eventually get to it. So I kind of burned a little bit of time during the day. Like, I don't know why I didn't do that the few days before. I think we were busier than I expected to be. Like once my crew came into Vegas, I really wanted to spend a lot of like time with them, not focused on the race, but just like hanging out and like just bonding. We actually, on Friday before the race, we did a 10-mile run like through Vegas. And I thought to myself, is this too much? But I was like, whatever, we're having fun. And like, I'm going to make it through the race anyways, right? I'm like, who cares?
Right.
Anyways, race morning, I really didn't like sleep throughout the day. I think we left Lone Pine about 3 o'clock. So that gave us 5 hours to get out to Badwater Basin. I think it took us about 3.5. I think we stopped a few places to pee. I told my crew that I wanted to have lunch, but I didn't want to have a big dinner meal before I started the race, because I've done other races where I start at night. One particularly earlier this year where I ate a hamburger before the race, and I just felt terrible the entire night. So I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to eat a hamburger. I'm not going to have a big meal. I just wanted to have some snacks, basically.
Yep.
And we got out to the race. So we got out to the race.
There I am.
And we basically had about an hour at least to burn. So my crew was like kind of preparing the first bottles. We were discussing, you know, we were going to go 3 miles out for the first stop, which is what Chris and the race crew recommends, because, you know, you've got probably 33 people leaving off the line at the same time, and you got all these vans. And then at the same time, you have runners coming in for the next waves down the same road. So it can get quite busy. So we discussed that. The bathrooms at Badwater Basin, I will say, are an experience. If you never have to go in them, that would be great. There's like this serious ammonia smell. It's so, so bad. It's like, it is something that will stick with you for the rest of your life.
That's terrible.
The smell that comes out of the pit toilets there. You know, and like, it's probably just due to the heat. Like, there's nothing the Park Service can do about that. But wow, they are ripe. So anyways, we got myself all together. I, you know, put some anti-chafing stuff on. I like Tutom's Sports Shield, which is like amazing. Please, if you have chafing issues, look it up. It's like the number two. And then Tom's Sports Shield, not sponsored, but I wish I was, because I love that stuff. It's great. So lubed myself up, got the bottles ready. You have to do a medical check-in where you get weighed just in case they, you know, you have an emergency, like during the race, they need to know what your starting weight is. So I got weighed in. And for if anybody's wondering, I was 144 pounds. So got weighed in. And we took some photos, and then I got back in the car to stay in like the air conditioning. And I think like I was just really excited at that time. I think my crew was excited, you know, as more, we were one of the first cars in the parking lot. And then as more crews arrive, like it just gets busier and busier, and the buzz like is just like building, you know. Chris called us all to the start line. He asked if there were any military or veterans in the field. And I am a Marine Corps veteran. So I raised my hand, which I think a lot of people didn't know. Even Chris was like, what service were you in? And I was like, oh, I was in the Marine Corps. So we did, you know, Joyce Lee sang the national anthem. And then before we knew it, like we were counting down and we were off. And it's really cool because you kind of go up the ramp to the parking area and all your crews are like lined alongside. Like there's just all these yellow shirts. So everybody has to wear a high vis shirt when they're crewing. So like pretty much everybody's wearing the same thing. And you just see like all these yellow shirts, you know, everybody's cheering, which was really cool. And we got out the road and like we had this just incredible tailwind, like I was telling you about earlier. I mean, it was, everything felt so effortless for like 20 something miles. That thing was behind us. We got past Furnace Creek, which is the first checkpoint at 17 something miles. I think I was like one of the first three runners there, which is a little surprising for me. And I told myself, I'm like, oh my God, like, are you going too fast? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, whatever, drive the car into the ground and pick up the pieces and redo it all over again, if that's what's going to happen. You know, I was like, it is like, take it when you can get it. And that's actually how I run a lot of my races. Like I don't necessarily run for a goal time or whatever. I very rarely race something, which I think is another reason I probably got put in the first wave, because my results don't necessarily indicate how fast I can run.
Right.
Because I'm not always pushing. I just enjoy like the experience of like being around other people and like the whole entire race thing, seeing someplace new. But when I like put my foot on the gas, sometimes I can come away with a decent result. So I think that was another factor in me being in that first wave. Kind of am jumping around here.
That's fine.
So yeah, we had this incredible tailwind all the way to like Furnace Creek. It was great. And I considered, should I slow down, especially when I found myself passing some elite runners, which was a little scary. I'm like, why am I in front of this person? And I just told myself like, you know, I don't know what's going on in that person's life. And maybe they're having a bad day or they're going through something that I don't know about, but like, just keep rolling with what you're doing. And I told myself, don't let that get in your head because you're in front of this person that you feel like you shouldn't be, you know, because that was like a real thing. Multiple times I was near one or more people that I felt like I should have been behind, which was surprising for me, but I was just like, you know what? Just roll with it. Like whatever happens, happens. And maybe this is your time to shine.
Hi, everybody. Another one of my workout staples are these chews from Performance Bullet. I've taken them on the runs, hikes, and heavy lift days. Caffeine bullets from Performance Bullet aren't like regular gels, drinks, or pills. All of their chews use buccal absorption, meaning the caffeine is absorbed through your cheek and gums. This way, it hits your bloodstream in as little as 5 minutes, kicking in up to 3 times faster than other sources of caffeine. That faster release is a game changer, especially mid-run when you need the energy right now. Caffeine bullets improve performance across all distances, from 5Ks to ultras, and in every type of training run, whether it's intervals, tempos, and those dreaded long runs. Together, they help you train better, recover stronger, and set new PRs. And for a limited time, if you use the code RUNNINGFORBEGINNERS when checking out at performancebullets.com, you'll get 20% off your purchase. Just use the code RUNNINGFORBEGINNERS.
So that's a great segue. So now you're at the finish. Take me through the moment when you realize you're actually going to finish the 135. What did that feel like?
Well, I never felt like I wouldn't finish, but like the ultimate, like, I think when you go through Lone Pine, you're like, okay, now I just have this 13 miles up to the Mount, you know, up the Mount Whitney Portal Road. And that, it's almost like your victory lap, but it's a very, very, very long one because that road is incredibly steep. It's, I think it's like 13 miles, like 5,000 feet of gain or something. I want to say like it gets steeper as you get higher, you know, but I hiked pretty much that entire thing and I was very, very, very sleepy. So I was like getting in our van, laying down for like 5 minutes. My crew thankfully was being gracious with me because I was like, oh my God, I was like, I'm going to fall asleep right now, like while I'm walking, you know? So I, you know, like the writing was on the wall, like once you get climbing up that road, but you know that you still have like hours left. So it can be very daunting and you're just like, oh my God, where, like when you even see the first like switchback, you can see it for miles. So you're like, when am I going to get to that point where you start seeing it like traverse, you know? And I guess, I think once you, there's a certain point in the race where you kind of curve around and then you're under some tree coverage. That's when you're like, okay, I'm close. Like I knew just get to this spot where the trees are, you kind of like tuck back into the mountain. It's like, just get to that spot. And then you're like almost there, you know? And I even remember like 2.5 miles out, my crew's like, 2.5 miles, like you're almost there. And I'm like, it's going to be a freaking hour. It's going to be an hour, you guys. Like it's so, and it's like, I'm going to make it, but gosh, it feels like forever to go those, especially when I was like cruising the first 100 miles, you know, whatever. I felt like, right. I mean, I went through the 100 mile mark 23:50-ish, which I felt like really good about, but then you're like reduced to only hiking for most people. You know, I think Max, who won the race, I think he ran every step of that, which is absolutely insanity. I'm telling you, and Carmen probably ran most of it too. Like those, they're crazy. They're crazy, incredible athletes, like just like very talented. There's probably other people that ran it too that I just don't know their names. But for most of the field, like we end up hiking that. And then basically right before the finish line, probably like 100 or 200 yards, or there's a parking lot and your crew can park there and then you can all cross the finish line. And I was just like so grateful to be there. And I was, you know, like one of the things I was thinking about was like, there's a pizza party that's like after the night of the race. It starts at like 8 p.m. at the Lone Pine High School. And I remember thinking to myself, yes, we are going to be able to sleep before we go to the pizza party. I was so excited about that because last year when John finished, we had very little time in between. And we were just like, it's like trying to prop your eyeballs up like while people are getting announced and like you're just so, we were wrecked and tired, like the whole crew was just ridiculous, you know.
That's insane.
We're like, how long till it's over? But we got to sleep a little bit. That's actually what went through my mind. And just really, I was very excited to be able to like thank, you know, Chris for allowing me the opportunity to run the race, and just the whole background of like how long that journey actually was, because from, you know, 2012 to now, it's like 14 years. That was a long time, I felt like, for me to get to the race.
Sure.
And most of that was due to, for me, it felt like financial barriers that kept me away for so long. You know, I think for the last several years, I felt like, you know, I could afford to do it, because there is a expense that goes into running this race, not just like with the entry fee, like obviously like that has to be charged because you have permits and staff and all these things, right? But like also getting your crew. So when you come from somewhere that's away from that race, the expense is greater because you don't, you know, you have to fly your crew in. You could, there's plenty of people that love the race that would be willing to crew and pace and help. But I really wanted like the people that I'm close right. with my life now to be there.
Sure. That's not. So if a new runner, intermediate, somebody who doesn't have decades of experience underneath their belt, what would you say to that marathoner listening right now who thinks there's no way I could ever run an ultra?
You just have to try. You just have to like decide you're going to do it and just like go for it. Because what happens if you don't make it? Nothing really, right? Mm-hmm. So like, I mean, I think most people can physically run 100 miles or complete a 100 miler. Shouldn't say run because, you know, obviously like we do some hiking and those. Mm-hmm. But I think people have to decide that they want to do it and then they have to like put in the work. Like you're not going to finish it if you don't put in the work. You know, it's going to be so many more times harder than if you just decide to do the training. But I truly believe that most people, like if it was a life or death situation, you could get to 100 miles, right?
Sure.
So if you train for it and you know it's coming and you want to do it, I think most people can do it. And I would say that don't sell yourself short because right. most of us do that.
So do you think it's about being an exceptionally, you know, gifted runner, smart runner, a well-trained runner, a combination, or a stubborn, someone determined, has a lot of grit? I assume these are all characteristics of somebody, but, you know, it kind of curious all of those
what you think. I think all of those things help, but like, you don't have to like have some like fantastic like genes, like in your, like my parents aren't runners, you know, like
sure.
neither of my parents are runners. They're not like endurance athletes. And I think it's just like deciding and then putting in the work. I think all the things that you just named help. And I also think like sometimes like we have to draw on hard things. Like, so there has certainly been like a lot of trauma in my childhood. And I think sometimes people think that's why I run, but it truly is not. Like, I love running just to run. I love just running, get through this.
Right.
I think like finding the tools and the ways and the reasons to finish something, if you can do that. And I mean, obviously if you put in the work and you're gritty and you're determined and all of that helps, but like, you don't have to be superhuman. You don't have to have the perfect body. Like, I don't have a perfect body. I don't have a six pack. I wish I did. Have extra skin or fat in areas that I wish I didn't. Like, you don't have to be perfect. Like, you don't have to train 100 miles a week to complete an ultra. You know, you can do it on a little bit more than marathon training. If you want to run 100 miles, is it going to be a little more difficult the least amount of miles you do? Yes. If you do more miles, it's going to be easier because your body is used to doing that. You know, our bodies are incredibly capable of adapting to things. And when you build over the years a lot, like a base of fitness, and you just keep building and building and building and building, things get easier. You know, consistent training and consistency is key. I just had this conversation with someone yesterday. Like, how do I get better? And my own philosophy is like, try not to take more than 2 days of running off in a row. Because I feel like when you take that third day, you like take a step backwards. That is not science backed. That is not, I'm not a coach. I'm not a professional, but like, that's my own experience is like, if you don't take, you know, I feel like if you take more than 2 days off in a row of running, then you're going to take a step backwards. So I think sure. being consistent is the most important thing. I'm actually doing a little run streak because when I got hurt, I was frustrated with not being able to do high mileage, which I love. I love running long. I like being outside for hours. Like, I am happiest outside. I don't love being inside. I don't love being trapped. I want to sure. be outside, exploring, doing whatever, getting myself into some baloney because I mapped a trail that maybe doesn't exist. I love doing stuff like that. Oh, I'm on a run streak because I couldn't do the mileage that I wanted right. to do when I got hurt. So I just was like, I'm going to run every day. So I don't know what day I'm on, 120.
Good for you.
I don't know.
So I guess it does take a little bit of crazy to do an ultra.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, well, I think you have to be open to knowing that there might be some suffering.
You I know? Was just going to say something very similar to that, starting with, you have to be open. I think you know, just from the people I've talked to and, you know, the one race that I just decided to do, I think you have to be open to the challenge, to the discomfort that you might expect, or at least know that there might be discomfort.
Yes. And it's going to happen. It's yeah, just a matter of
I just won't quit. That's my thing. I'm just that stubborn. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but I was violently ill a day before my marathon in Austin, and I had to fly to Texas from here. So the night before my flight, I was violently ill. The day I got to Texas, I got to hang out in the hotel room, but I couldn't eat or drink anything because it just, I felt like crap. The next morning was the race. So I had a power bar or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I did crappy. And I was just guzzling water, drink, running down the thing a lot faster, a lot more than I ever would have. And I just decided, you know what? I'm going to run it. I know I'm not 100%, but I'm not going to quit. I came all this way. I got the bib from Shocks. So I'm like, my entry was paid by them. So I was like, I'm going to do this and screw it, you know? And I'm just, I knew I was going to be in pain and uncomfortable, but I was not going to give up.
You know what? I'm going to give you kudos for that because some people, when they get a free entry, they don't utilize it. And that is like the most frustrating thing because these people gave you something and they intended for you to use it. And like, regardless of what the result was going to be, you're like, I'm going to show up. And that really is the most important thing. I love that story. And I love hearing that. Like, I think it's incredibly important when someone gives you something, like when they put something on a silver platter for you. For example, Hoka supporting me with shoes. Like, I'm so thankful for that. Like, those are things that people don't have to do for us. And like, when we are gifted those things, we should utilize it to the...
And it's not like you can't afford a pair of shoes yourself.
Right.
Yeah. So it means a lot, no matter what it is.
It does. It, you know, of course, yeah, I can buy shoes, but does it help when you get this extra support? Especially when you're doing something that has a long lead up or...
You're going through shoes five times faster than anyone else.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah. Every time I buy a new set of shoes or a new grouping of shoes for the year, my wife's like, oh my God, another 5 pair. Oh my God.
Yeah. But I love that you still decide to show up, you know?
Yeah. I hate to say it. Me and my buddy have a rule. Don't quit and don't shit. But
I don't know. Number two, I break all the time.
Well, when I get past the 50K mileage, then that one might have to go out the window. But I've been very lucky that I've never quit. Oh, there's your runner. Oh, that's okay.
He's in his underwear.
It looks like running tights. Who knows? He's going on a run.
My goodness.
There we go. That's fine. That'll be one of the clips I'm going to keep in. So what's your next last question before we go? We've been chatting for a while, which I incredibly appreciative of. What's your next big race? What's your next ultra? What are you doing?
I am running. It's called Pine Creek Challenge 100 Miler. And I am scheduled to pace my friend Frank from start to finish through that race. So that's nice. September 12th, I think.
Where's that? Where's Pine Creek at?
It's in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Not sure exactly where, but I think it's a mostly like a flatter race. It's going to be his first attempt at, he's run our timed race. We have a timed race called Haynesport Endurance Run. And he did 100 miles there, not last year, but the year before. So this is going to be his first attempt at a regular, like standalone 100 miler. So I'm supposed to pace him from start to finish.
Nice. I guess it's going to be the actual last question because you brought it up and it made me think about it. Is there a progression you think people should do if they want to get into ultra running? Should they go from a 50K to 100K to a 50 miler to 100 miler to a 125? Or do you think at some point, whenever they feel comfortable, you know what I mean? They can just jump from a 1 to a 135 instead of a 125. Or, I mean, I interviewed an ultra runner. She did that Red Rocks or whatever it was, the 250. Mm-hmm. And she's done like 70 ultras. And you would not think by the look of her that she would have done 70 ultras. I mean, it's just deceiving. But I don't know if there's a standard route people go.
Well, I think a lot of people go, you know, marathon, 50K, 50 miler, 100K, 100 miler, but I feel like rules are made to be broken. So I think people should do whatever they want to do. You know, obviously there's a big difference between running a marathon and 50 miler, but there's not so much of a difference between marathon and like 50K, which is why I think I skipped that. I was just like, I know I could do 6 more miles. Like that didn't feel like a big deal to me. So I didn't care. But also there's a significant difference between 50 miles and 100 miles. There is a lot that happens between 50 and 100 miles, I'll be honest. And even between 100K and 100 miles, there's a lot that just that even when you're trained well, that's typically where maybe the wheels might fall off a little bit or something like that, you know. But I don't think that anybody should follow any hard and fast rules. Now there are some races where in order to get into that, like there are a couple hundred milers there's probably many 100 milers where you have to have run either a 50 miler or something like that. And so you'd have to follow
that application process, right?
Yeah, to get into particular races. But I don't see any reason, you know, in my opinion, if you, so like, I think a good example of this is my, as a timed race that we put on, people come out there and they sign up sometimes for 48 hours and they don't really know like how many loops they're going to do. And if they do, you know, a 50K or they do 50 miles or 100K, like, I think those are good platforms for just like seeing how you feel about going that certain distance. The only problem with timed races is you have an easy out. And if you are not very strong in your mind, it's very easy to quit those early. So I would,
sure.
I personally, so my favorite races are like point to points just because I get to see something new. And I'm always like, I'm a person, I'm like, I don't have roots. I'm made to see everything. I want to, it's, I don't do the same races very often. I like to like, I want to do a new race in a new area, a new place, unless it's like super local to me and it's super convenient or whatever.
Sure.
But you won't find me traveling like across the country to run the same race over and over again. Although I will say, I don't think I'm done at Badwater. I don't know how I'm going to afford to try to do it again, but I feel like I definitely, like, I want to take another stab because I am very confident that I can do better. I'm just like with running the entire race now, you know, from start to finish. And also, you know, it would have been lovely if I didn't have an injury in the middle of my training block. I am very curious to see where I actually would have ended up because I would love that. I put a little feeler, I put a little feeler out to them, but I don't know. We'll see.
Somebody
who wants to help. I would love that. I just, you know, it's hard to justify that expense when it's pretty much like a, I mean, you can, I guess, make it as cheap as you want to be. But like, I also want my crew to be comfortable. I want my crew to fly out a couple days before. I want to have accommodations for them that are comfortable. Like, we're not camping out there, you know? So is there ways to like cut the cost? And is it, you know, could I pick a different crew? Yes. But I you know, it's hard. I don't want to dissuade people from like trying to like put that race on their radar because it is fantastic. Like, they do an incredible job of like putting the race together, and every penny of what they charge for registration fee is absolutely worth it. And it is necessary, I'm confident, to like make that race go forward. But you know, there's this, the other expenses, like just getting out there.
Sure.
And
sure.
All that stuff. So.
Yeah. And you're going from all the way across the country.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is crazy because I lived there at one point, just 3 hours from where the race is. But I wasn't in like the position that I am now, you know?
Sure. Very cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, obviously. I love this chat.
Thanks for letting me share. I'm excited to talk about Badwater all the time.
Yeah, very cool. Well, after hearing about Vanessa's describing the Badwater 135, I think we can all agree that 135 miles is a completely different conversation than 26.2. What really stood out to me wasn't simply the distance. It was everything that comes with that distance: the heat, fatigue, the nutrition, the hydration, the sleep deprivation, the emotional highs and lows, and the constant mental battle between I can keep going and I don't know if I can take another step. And that's one of the things I love about running. You don't have to run 135 miles to understand that lesson. Every runner eventually reaches a point where something gets hard. Maybe it's your first mile. Maybe it's your first 5K. Maybe it's mile 20 of a marathon. That was me. And sometimes the biggest challenge isn't what's happening to your legs. It's what's happening in your head. Vanessa Klein just took that lesson to an extreme level at Badwater. And if this episode made you curious about the other side of ultra running, stay tuned, because our conversation about Vanessa's work with Beast Pacing is a different look at the sport, what pacers actually do, why they matter, and how they fight right beside you and help you accomplish something you may not believe you're capable of. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow or subscribe to Running for Beginners, wherever you're listening. And if you know of another runner who would find the Badwater 135 story fascinating, send this episode their way. Until next time, let's run forward together.
I hope you hit the like button, follow the podcast, and share with your social media contacts. You never know who in your circle has wanted to run, but for whatever reason was too shy or fearful to undertake the challenge. I hope to point out the inclusiveness of running and give information that is accessible and relatable from a relatively new runner's perspective. Don't forget, you're responsible for your own health. Please talk to your doctor if necessary before starting any new physical activity. and nothing said on this podcast by myself or the guests should be construed as medical advice. Any products advertised on the show and purchased using the code RUNWITHMARK will earn me a commission. This podcast was created, written, produced, edited by myself, Mike Fleming. Show music is Every Day to Play by Ethos.